Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, a podcast about the transformative and healing power of sex, pleasure, and embodied sexuality. I'm your host, Morgan Susan Taylor. I'm a sex therapist and specialist in women's sexuality and the founder of the Pathway to Pleasure Collective, where I am passionate about normalizing the conversation on sexuality while building a bridge between the sexual and the spiritual. I created the Sex Talk Cafe as a place for you to learn from the experts in the field of somatic sex education, sex therapy, and sacred sexuality so that you can remove the mystery from sex, release guilt and shame, and learn to live a sexually empowered life filled with more confidence, connection, intimacy, and love. Thank you for joining me. The routine practice of circumcision on baby boys in the United States has become a cultural norm, whose benefit and purpose is seldom questioned. Citing sanitation and health benefits to the upholding of ancient religious beliefs, proponents of the practice defend its necessity. But for those who oppose the practice, a different story emerges. Through their eyes, we are shown a practice that is not supported by scientific fact, but rather upheld by outdated and oftentimes misinformed moral and cultural beliefs, raising questions about human rights, the right to pleasure, and the role of consent. No matter where you stand on the issue, would it be reasonable to suggest that you owe it to yourself and to our society to dig a little deeper and get the full picture? And could it be possible that both men and women and our society as a whole lose more than we realize by the perpetuation of this practice? We cannot go back, and nobody is wrong for making the choice they made based on what they thought was best and true at the time. But I believe that we must look forward to the future we want to create. And to do that, we must re-examine the foundation upon which our past choices were made. Today, I'm interviewing a very special guest, Brendan Murata, who is the filmmaker for the documentary American Circumcision. And in this groundbreaking documentary film, Brendan really covers both sides of the issue. We hear from mothers, sons, fathers, brothers, doctors, scholars, and scientists as they reveal the inconvenient truths behind this practice, while also illuminating some of the questionable values and beliefs that drive its continuation. Join me today for the interview with filmmaker Brendan Murata, and then decide for yourself where you stand on this issue. Brendan, thanks so much for being here and welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thanks for having me on.
Would you just introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners and just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Brendan Murata. I am a filmmaker, and I spent 6 years making a feature-length documentary called American Circumcision, which is about the modern circumcision debate and the growing movement that says that men should be able to make their own choices about their bodies, and that includes circumcision. So that, I think, is probably the focus of what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, first of all, your film is extremely well done. I watch a lot of documentaries, and literally yours is one of the best.
Thank you.
And I think that you won an award on this film as well at the Lone Star Film Fest.
We got a couple awards, and the film is out now on Amazon, iTunes, Netflix, and everywhere you watch movies.
Fantastic. All right, everybody listening, go watch the documentary American Circumcision. You can get it. It's out there. Well, I'm curious what led you to want to make a film on this issue?
So, like most Americans, circumcision wasn't something I thought a lot about. I knew I always wanted to make films, and I was doing other things in the film industry and enjoying making, you know, narrative films and sort of escapist stuff. But I also went through a period in my life where I was doing a lot of healing work, and I became interested and how events early on in our life affect us later on. And in the research and also the personal work I did on myself, I discovered that, you know, those events affect us a lot. And one of the things I found out about in that process was circumcision. Circumcision in America, in most of its history, has been done without anesthesia. And even now, the rate of anesthesia is, you know, it's sometimes used and it's sometimes not. And even when it is used, it's often not effective because you can't put a baby under full anesthesia. Mm-hmm. So that surprised me. And I thought, okay, well, if people have trauma in their life from just smaller things like bad parenting or not being held or separation from the mother, mm-hmm. what would holding someone down and cutting off part of their body do? But, you know, that was something that it took me a while to actually explore and think about. But when I did, I discovered there's a lot of information that people don't know about this subject. And part of the goal of the documentary was to share that information with a wider audience. So film is what I've loved doing. It's what I've always done. And it made sense to use those skills on this particular subject. And that led me across the country interviewing all sorts of different people from different backgrounds, people who are experts in sexuality and trauma and early life development and medicine and law, and creating the film that takes those 6 years of research and condenses it down to something that you can understand in 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, you did a phenomenal job at that. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the film is that it really did a great job at showing the issue from both sides of the debate. And I felt like that was really valuable. I feel like it really presents, you know, the perspectives of the people that vehemently support this practice and then the people that are really advocating to bring it into it in a very sort of just by presenting the facts and presenting the opinions and presenting the beliefs. It's not, I love that. I think you really leave the viewer with the ability to really make their own decision based on what was presented.
Thank you. I appreciate you noticing that, because there's a style of documentary now that's sort of documentary as op-ed. And I think that's a legitimate style that works for some topics, but my goal with this was to try to make every perspective heard and then allow the audience to come to their own perspective.
Exactly. Which, you know, I think it's more effective, particularly, you know, I didn't realize really what a sensitive issue this is. And I think that, you know, we have to be able to open a platform for everybody to come to the table and really look at what's going on without trying to shame somebody for the choices that they've made. Because I think around this particular issue, you know, that's a problem that I've run into, is I've been posting about this on my Facebook page and really, you know, starting to become an advocate for this cause, is that, you know, a lot of people, like you said, like it's something that a lot of people don't want to look at. And I'm just wondering what you have found around that, if that's due to, I think it's due to maybe shame or the fear of admitting that, like, maybe we made a choice that really wasn't the best choice.
Yeah, circumcision is a challenge because it's an identity level issue. So on most other surgeries, you say that there's something that happened to you. You'd say, I had shoulder surgery, or I had to have surgery for this particular thing.
Right.
But with circumcision, people say, I am circumcised, oh, or my children were circumcised.
Right.
And they use the same language that you would use if you were saying, you know, I am a woman or I am gay. And when you suggest that that might not have been a good choice, people respond with the same triggered or offended state they might have if you were to criticize one of their immutable characteristics.
Wow.
But in reality, circumcision is just something that happened to you. No one is born circumcised. And around most of the world, it is not the norm.
Right.
Most of the world does not practice circumcision and is intact.
Yeah. Wow. That's a really interesting statement. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that definitely makes sense. You know, I wonder too, you know, when we talk about like the, you know, the trauma, and I think if anyone who watches your film, I think it would make sense. I think that, you know, what really stood out for me was the part where I think it's that woman, Marilyn, where she very clearly says, you know, the first, they're cleaning the baby's penis and babies get a little erection from that. And then their very first sexual experience is met with pain.
Right.
So it seems very obvious to me that, yeah, absolutely, that, you know, the body stores the memory, right? Mm-hmm. That would be a trauma that could be embedded and later show up in later life as, you know, potential problems. But I also see so many men who respond, well, I'm fine. Like, it was fine. It didn't bother me. And I just wonder if you could speak to that a little bit more.
When you make this statement, I'm fine, that assumes circumcision is default. The question I would ask is, what about your foreskin displeased you? What about that part of the body do you think was wrong? There's a frame in a lot of these answers. And a lot of the, when you talk about circumcision with people, a lot of the responses you get may sound very bizarre. And that's because they're not intended to be logical arguments. They're intended to preserve that identity and another belief that might come in if they were to accept information about this.
Right. Which
so if it, well, if it's true that circumcision is harmful, what does that mean? If you're a man who's circumcised, it might mean that something bad happened to you. It might mean that your parents didn't protect you. It might mean that you can't feel the full sexual experience you were born with. These are all things that are really difficult for men to feel. And for men, the biggest taboo or source of shame is being weak. Men are not allowed to be weak. And to be honest, we don't want to be weak.
Sure.
You know, even if it was okay for us to be that, it's not something that we desire to be.
Sure.
And so if this is true, then there might be a feeling that that other thing is also true. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that confronting the traumas that happen to you requires strength. Mm. And so there's a fear, like, if I explore that, that I will experience weakness. But if you actually explore it, you will develop strength. Mm-hmm. So many of the replies that people get are a defense against feeling the feelings that this issue might bring up.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Yeah, I think that's what makes it so challenging and why so many people want to cling on to the reasoning for it. Like, it's cleaner, or it's safer, or it protects against, you know, STDs. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
So a lot of these don't make a lot of sense the further you get into them. And they also frame that part of the body in a particular way. So you say, well, it's cleaner. Like, what does that mean? You know, do you not have access to soap and water? Is the way that you clean things by cutting them off? Is the are the sexual body parts, like, inherently dirty in some way and in need of removing? Are men born broken and they have to be fixed surgically? Like, there's a lot of implications of those statements that when you start to examine them make very little sense and honestly don't fit into people's other worldviews. So if you're someone who is listening to a podcast like this and probably consider sexuality healthy and good, why would the sexual body parts that every person is born with, or every man is born with, excuse me, be somehow dirty or wrong or in need of fixing? You know, it doesn't fit with the other beliefs that people have.
Right.
Now, you can go into the reasons and justifications people use for those claims. And in our film, we get really in depth on some of the studies on, you know, claiming that there's a correlation between that and sexually transmitted diseases, especially the HIV claim. But to do that, you have to get really deep on some of the science and the methodology of the science and the contra studies that suggest the opposite. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that most people are that's actually a deciding factor for them.
Sure.
It's a cultural factor. It's a psychological one. It's something else. You know, and virtually all of those studies disappear if you include things like condoms or safe sex, because we all know that that's the most, you know, the easiest way to prevent sexually transmitted diseases.
Yeah, or soap and water.
Right.
I mean, we, you know, a vagina is self-cleaning. We don't go around cutting off little girls' labias
because
they're dirty, or the argument about bladder infections, which are four times more likely in girls than in boys and women than in men. And yet, you know, that's one of the excuses used for circumcision.
And that's one of the things about the framing of this is we don't look at any other body part and go, what are the risks and benefits of having this body part? You know, could I prevent ear infections if I remove my ears? Right. Could I prevent nose infections if I cut off my nose? Like, what's the risk benefit analysis on that? You know, maybe you might get an ear infection later in life and have to have it done later. Like, you should just chop it off when the child is born, right? And if someone proposed that, you would think that they were insane and should be not allowed near children. Right. But on this one body part, we've normalized it. And I think that part of that comes from what you might call a cultural trance, you know, that when you start actually looking at it and breaking that trance, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But because culture has framed that body part in a certain way, and there's lots of authority figures telling you it's okay, then people don't actually critically think about it.
Exactly. And yeah, I did a post about this not too long ago, but you know, the routine practice of tonsillectomy in young children, that was like a regular thing that was just sort of done, whether there was a problem or not. And then partly due to just more, you know, social education, as well as doctors that started to realize this isn't really the panacea cure that we had hoped it would be. It doesn't really cure all these upper respiratory tract infections, and it stopped, it fell out of fashion. They stopped doing it, and it makes sense. Wait till there's an actual infection. And you know, that's what I find so stunning about the practice of circumcision is that, you know, why not just wait until there's actually a problem, which is very, very rare. Even phimosis, which is another excuse that I hear about why it's so good, even that's extremely rare. It's like less than 1% of men, and usually it's teenagers, less than 1% of men aged 16 to 18 where that is an issue. And if it's truly, you know, prohibitive or there's really a problem, then it, you know, circumcision might be the right answer for that. But, you know, just to sort of prophylactically remove the foreskin in order to avoid this thing that may or may not happen at some distant point in the future, it's ludicrous.
Even that word prophylactic, it's sort of a euphemism, right? Because we're talking about someone holding down a child, forcibly penetrating part of that child and cutting off part of his body. Yeah. Like when you remove the euphemism, it seems absurd. Your comment about doctors reminded me, I was reading earlier and I ran across a quote from Napoleon that doctors will have more lives to answer for in the next world than even we generals. And of course, in his time, they were doing, you know, bloodletting with leeches and things like that. There's a very strange framing there. And even, you know, people talk about there being other issues with the foreskin later. First, we don't frame other body parts that way. We don't say we should remove women's breasts because of breast cancer.
Right.
But part of that, too, is that doctors don't know how to care for the foreskin. So when it's been removed from most of the population, you know, the foreskin is fused to the head of the glands, kind of like your fingernail is fused to your finger. And one of the first things that happens in circumcision is that that is broken away. So they shove a blunt probe in there to remove it, forcibly penetrating the child. And then when a child is left intact, they say, well, you have to clean under there. Well, you don't clean under your fingernails. You only clean what is seen. And the actual way to care for an intact child is to only clean what is seen, that he's the first person who attracts that.
Right.
But if a doctor doesn't know that, he might forcibly retract the child. And they've done surveys in which I think it's 60% of parents with intact children have a doctor try to forcibly retract their child. No. Now, of course, if you pulled someone's fingernail off, there's going to be infections, right? So they do this forcible retraction of the majority of intact children, causing them pain, causing damage, and they go, oh, this body part must just be so prone to infection. We better cut it off, right? So they don't know how to care for it. And then they use their incompetence to as a justification for further interventions and things that hurt children.
Right. Wow. And yeah, I mean, that's just shocking. And, you know, I think the other side to this as well, you know, as well as doctors not knowing how to care for a foreskin because they're becoming such a rare thing, you also have this strange cultural phenomenon that's happened where, you know, an intact penis is, there's shame. I have known men that have shame or grew up with great, great shame because their penis didn't look like the penises of the other men and boys. and they would try to hide the fact that they had a foreskin. I'm wondering if you want to speak to that a little bit.
Well, I want to correct you on it being a rare thing, because the rate now is around 50%, maybe less, which means that it's actually a really common thing.
It means I need to date younger men. Is that what you're telling me?
Maybe. If that's what you're looking for, the chances increase there. Or European men.
European men. There you go.
People from around the world.
Yeah.
It's not as rare a thing in the younger generations, but you're right, there's a stigmatization there. And that stigmatization is even in the language. So when we talk about people who still have their foreskin, they're referred to as uncircumcised, right, implying that circumcision is the norm.
Yep.
And then men who've had this surgery, which is unnatural, we call circumcised, implies norm. And so a lot of people in the movement against circumcision will refer to it as intact or whole or natural or something like that. Because you wouldn't refer to a woman as like unmasectomied, right?
Right.
You just say she's normal.
Right. Yeah, that's such a good point. Yeah, what do you know about, you know, so I know one of the things that you say in your film, or that you reveal in your film, that these, you know, when there are circumcision injuries or botched circumcision, that there's no regulations around that for reporting?
Yeah, it's a extremely common thing. And part of the challenge of it is that it's often not even known or seen until later. So there's no dotted line on men that says cut here, right? Like, we're not born with a body part intended to be removed. So there's a wild variation between different types, even of male circumcision. Some people have more removed than others. Some still have their frenulum or parts of the foreskin. It actually varies a lot person to person. But if you're a man and you're not with other men, then what you have is what you know. So there's not, it's not like that most men are actually not comparing their bodies with others in that way.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are some injuries that are so severe that they're seen and are known about. So if you cause the child to bleed out, or even there's circumcision deaths during the surgery, there are children who scream so loud during the procedure that their lungs burst. Those things are known. But again, they're not always reported as caused by circumcision. They'll say, oh, it was caused from hemorrhaging or bleeding, right? Well, why was he bleeding? You know, This was for the procedure being done. And sometimes there's a lawsuit and they go to trial, but then you have a jury or a judge who comes from a circumcising culture, and you have to convince them of the damage that was done, and they might not understand that. So those cases are difficult to win, despite how horrific they sometimes are, and they tend to play like other malpractice cases.
Right.
But there's no statistic keeping on it, because how would that help the medical industry? They don't want to have this large body of data that indicates that one of the most common practices they do is harmful to children.
For sure. It certainly wouldn't help them. And I guess what I wonder, as far as the movement goes, for the intactivist movement, do you think that that would be a direction to move in towards actually getting some kind of legislation passed or regulations implemented that would require reporting?
So the intactivist movement, which is a combination of the word intact and activists working for the intact body, there's a lot of ideas that people have talked about in that movement, and that's one of them. The challenge is that there is a heavy opposition response to any attempt to regulate what doctors can do. I mean, look at the debates that happen over existing issues around healthcare, and you'll see how difficult it is to pass that legislation. It is one of the most profitable industries in the world, and they don't like people telling them what to do, and they have enough money and power that there's a lot more access to that for them to politicians and political offices. Yeah. So it's a good idea if you can do it. And that is the challenge of virtually every activist thing you might do, is that they're all good ideas if you can do them.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do them, you have to go through the process of activism in order to get the resources and money and people together to pull them off.
Mm-hmm.
And on issues of legislation, there might be intense opposition response. So for example, one of the things that we cover in the film was the San Francisco male genital mutilation bill. Mm-hmm. Now, America used to have legislation against female genital cutting. That was actually overturned recently, which is a whole other story. Yeah, we could get into that. That's sort of a separate thing. But this bill was just a mirror of the law against cutting women's genitals and just changed the language of the gender and said, also, you can't cut men's genitals without their consent, right?
Right.
And so they tried to pass this in San Francisco, where if you just get a bunch of signatures, you can get something on the ballot. And boy, did opposition groups and Jewish groups go after them. Yeah. And they basically said, any attempt to regulate this is a form of anti-Semitism. That's my religion. That's part of my tradition. You're an evil person for trying to do that. Yeah. And they got a huge coalition of groups against them. They put stories in the media saying that they were bad people. Mm-hmm. And they also got a law firm that basically just constantly attacked the person behind the ballot initiative and kept him in court through most of the process, and even got a court to throw it off the ballot, saying that you couldn't do a bill like this. And then at the state level, they got a law passed in California saying that circumcision was protected and couldn't be regulated, and you couldn't do things that went against it.
And that's because of the religious reasoning behind it?
That was a big part of it. Medical groups were also involved, but the biggest was probably the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. And, you know, they're a multi-million dollar a year group, and they have access to every level of government. And when they put their resources behind it, it was a very difficult fight. So I think that things that go through that system, you have to be ready for that potential opposition. There is the possibility of sneaking something into the legislation, or, you know, doing something like I've seen some laws passed that I thought, you know, like there were some laws passed against gender transition surgery in one state, and the way that they were written was written that you couldn't do basically gender changing surgeries on children or surgery on like children's genitals. And I thought, you know, the language of that bill has some implications that the people who wrote it probably aren't aware of.
Right.
So there is the possibility of sneaking something in, I think, but if you're going to go, then you have to be smart about it. Right. So, and we're getting into the topic of activism here, which is a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. I tell that story to let people know there is a challenge to this. And I think when people discover the issue, their impulse is, well, this is so obviously wrong. Like, don't touch children or cut parts of their body off. Duh. Right.
Right.
That they think, well, then there should just be as simple a solution. We'll just tell people mm-hmm. not to do that, and we'll pass a law against it, or we'll file a lawsuit over it, and then it'll be done. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize the layers of psychological defenses people have. Like you were talking about when you started posting about it, that people had a very strong reaction to it. And they don't realize how those psychological defenses have become institutions designed to protect the practice.
Wow. Well, what do you think about the argument that it's the parent's choice, which I think you even reference in the film? There was some court case where that was the outcome of it. There was some kind of circumcision injury, and the courts ruled that this is a family matter and it's between the parents to decide. In terms of how that relates to consent.
Yeah, that is the direction that previously pro-circumcision groups have gone. So it used to be you actually didn't have choice as a parent. You went into the hospital and you signed a blanket consent form that said the hospital gets to do whatever it wants. And I know that when I was born, one of the things that my family said is the doctor basically said, this is what you should do, and you're an idiot if you don't do it, right? So this parental choice argument is actually new and did not exist when circumcision was at its most common in the United States. But it also doesn't fit with the other things that most of us believe about consent. So parents legally are guardians. Their job is to do what is going to protect their children. And you can't actually do things that harm children, even if it's your choice as a parent. So, for example, people can't refuse life-saving surgeries to children. There have been court cases where someone says, well, it's my religion. My child can't get a blood transfusion, even though they're bleeding out. Mm-hmm. And courts have ruled, we have to save your child's life because your child's life is more important than your belief system. People also take this attitude towards female circumcision and female genital cutting. There are people who say, well, cutting little girls' genitals is part of my culture. Mm-hmm. And we've ruled as a society in the past, you cannot hurt your child because of your belief system. You know, you can't, you couldn't, as a Christian couldn't tattoo a cross on a child's body. Like the idea that parents, it's a very bizarre idea of parenting to think that children are this thing that parents get to do whatever they want to, as opposed to that they are something that we need to understand and love and protect, right? Whenever I hear people say, well, it's my parental choice, you know, even if you were to accept that that is true, what are you trying to tell your children and teach them as a parent? Mm-hmm. Are you trying to teach them that their consent doesn't matter? And if you're bigger and stronger than someone, you get to do what you want to their body.
Right. And the argument around that I've heard is, well, as a parent, you know, my child doesn't get to consent to vaccines either, but I do it because that's what's in their best interest. Like, that's the argument that I've heard for the choice to circumcise.
Interestingly, even groups that practice circumcision, medical organizations, do not frame circumcision as being something done for health benefits anymore.
Really?
Or that as being the primary reason. Yeah, there's this sort of strange thing going on in the language. Well, I mean, first of all, so the largest medical organization that people reference on the circumcision debate is the American Academy of Pediatrics. Mm-hmm. Their policy statements expire, I think it's every 5 years. And so they have to either reaffirm the statement or write a new one. And so the last one they did was written in 2012 and it expired. And so technically they don't have a policy statement right now, but people still reference the 2012 statement as if it's a policy statement. And then that statement basically said, well, there's not enough to recommend it, but we think it should still be a parental choice because, you know, there's some reasons you might want to do it, basically. Hmm. But when you talk to, you know, I interview one of the people who was a part of that statement in the film, and he says, there's not really health benefits that are even worth mentioning or talking about.
Yeah.
So it, you know, when you frame it as like being like a vaccine, when people think about vaccines, the idea of a vaccine is that you take the vaccine and then if someone exposes you to a disease, you won't get it, right? So if someone who has measles sneezes on you or, you know, coughs in your direction, the idea is that you're protected. Mm-hmm. That's not true of circumcision. It's not like if you're circumcised, you can't get STDs anymore,
right?
And you don't need to use a condom. It's not a vaccine. And so to even, you know, and it's also really bizarre because on the vaccine debate, doctors will say there's no such thing as parental choice. You know, there's a lot of parents who say, well, I don't want my child to be vaccinated and that's my choice as a parent. And doctors groups say, no, you have to vaccinate your child. We're going to pass mandatory vaccine laws. You know, anti-vax parents who do that are bad and they shouldn't be allowed to do that. And then on the circumcision debate, they say, well, parental choice is the highest medical ethic, and you should be able to do things that might result in your child's death because it's your choice as a parent. Like, which ethic are we going with here? Like, what's going on?
That's such a good point. And hey, well, let's talk about what some of these complications are from circumcision, aside from death, which does happen. But, you know, what are some of the complications that men experience? Let's talk about grown men and infants.
Sure.
What are the complications from this practice?
So there's the experience of the child in that moment of pain, and there's the immediate potential complications of bleeding. And so for the first several weeks of that child's life, they're in pain because there's an open wound healing. So there's that. And then there's whatever lingering effects that experience might have. So this happens during the first days of a child's life when they are learning about whether or not the world is safe. And they're developing their mother-infant bond and learning if they can be safe in relationship. Mm-hmm. And all of those things are getting wired. And you might not remember those experiences consciously, but like we talked about, the body remembers. Mm-hmm. There is a learning that is taking place on an unconscious level, on a pre-verbal level, and on a somatic level.
Absolutely.
So there's those effects. Later in life, there are the effects of that surgery on the man's sexuality and then on his self-image. And those are going to be different person to person because not everyone experiences the world the same way and not every circumcision, like we've mentioned, is done the same. So on the sexual effects, the most sensitive and highest nerve ending parts of the body have been removed. And so sex is a different experience. And one of the ways I've heard it framed that I think is useful is that women's bodies have different types of orgasms that women can have. So if you touch a woman's clitoris, that's different than the G-spot, and there's different sensations there. And on men, the same is actually true. So there are different nerve endings there are nerve endings in the ridged band of the foreskin. And there are nerve endings in the frenulum, and there are nerve endings on the inside of the foreskin. And even though there may still be nerve endings in the head of the penis, the highest nerve endings are actually in the ridge band of the foreskin. And so that's gone. And the sensation you might have gotten from that is gone, which isn't to say there might not still be sensation that's really good. You know, if you were to remove a woman's clitoris, she could still feel her G-spot, right? And mm-hmm. that feels really good. But we wouldn't say that a woman who had that happen is getting the full experience of what her body is capable of. Mm-hmm. So there's a change there. The other thing that happens is what's known as keratinization. So the head of the glands is intended to be an internal organ, meaning that it's covered. And it's meant to be wet and mucosal. And when people often will shame men's bodies for having natural lubrication there, and they'll call it smegma, but that is the same lubrication that exists in women's bodies. So when a woman gets wet, she is making the same material that exists on a man's foreskin, and where both genders are supposed to have lubrication. So when people need to use lube, and the highest markets for personal lubricants, by the way, are the United States and Israel.
Oh, wow.
Then they're basically buying a synthetic version of what exists in the natural body and including the natural male body.
Sure.
So that's gone. And what happens instead is that there's keratinization. And keratinization is basically rough tissue that builds up on the head of the penis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you work with your hands a lot, they get calluses, right? And you probably have some keratinization on your elbow. And so if the head of your penis is constantly rubbing against the inside of your pants or whatever you're wearing, and it's supposed to be an internal organ, then it'll start to get rough. It's similar to like what would happen if you kept your tongue outside your mouth for weeks at a time. Like eventually it would dry out and have a different texture. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you can actually do as a man is if you cover that part of the body for an extended period of time, that keratinization will go away and there'll be some sensation that comes back to it. So you don't have as much sensitivity in your hands if you have huge calluses on them, but if you stop working with your hands for a while, they'll become softer and you might feel a bit more.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens is that the foreskin has a gliding, it's a gliding mechanism. So it actually rolls over top the head of the penis during sex. And instead of just using friction against the woman, the foreskin is rolling over that part of the body. And so it actually changes what that man needs to do to feel good during sex. So if that part of the body is rolling over itself, he's getting both the foreskin and the head of the penis touching each other, causing good sensation.
With less need for friction and thrusting.
Right. So you don't have to jackhammer it as right. much, basically.
Right. But I mean, so, you know, that's one of the reasons also that I'm so passionate about this. And I get asked, like, why are you so passionate about this men's issue? And I said, because this is relevant to women. It changes the way that we have sex. And one of the things that happens for women in sex is that constant thrusting and that need for repetitive friction and intensity that actually also hardens the vagina. It desensitizes the vagina. So, you know, this issue around male circumcision, it affects women as well, greatly and deeply. And sex with an intact man versus sex with a circumcised man, you know, not that I have a ton of experience, because like I said, for me, it's been a rare thing out there in the wild to find an intact penis, but it's like a totally different experience. And I think all penises are wonderful and beautiful, and I have no shame, but it's a very, very different experience. And I think that, you know, that's something that most people don't think about.
You know, that question, why would you care about a men's issue, is very revealing about our attitude towards men.
Yeah.
Because no one would ask me if little girls were having something bad happen to them or people were touching them without consent. Like, oh, why would you care about that as a man?
Right.
We just inherently know that women have value and that consent matters, and that we should inherently care about women's feelings because they're people.
Right.
But we don't have the same attitude towards men.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, wouldn't you agree? I think you touched on this in your film really nicely as well, that that's part of why this issue is sort of, it's unseen. I think the suffering that men do experience from this, there's, you know, they're either shamed or told to get over it, you know, or they don't have a place to really bring forth their experiences if they have been injured or damaged from this practice.
Yeah, there are a lot of mixed messages that men get in our culture now. We're sort of told that we need to open up about our feelings, but also get over them, and that they're not anyone else's problem, right? Mm-hmm. So for most of recorded history, men's weakness has been a survival liability, and men, in order to preserve their tribe or social group, have had to sacrifice their safety for the good of the tribe. So if you send a group of men into battle, you don't want one of those men going, wait a second, this experience is actually making me feel really vulnerable and dangerous, and I'm kind of scared, so I'm going to do something other than, you know, go out and defend the tribe, right? Yeah. So men have had to separate and fracture their own well-being from their ability to perform. Mm-hmm. And so when people see men going into those feelings, I think that there is sometimes an unconscious fear, mm-hmm. that if men don't feel safe or men actually go into that the tribe or the social group won't be safe.
Wow. Yeah, I think you're totally right on that. Absolutely.
Now, again, with this, I feel like what men are doing by exploring this issue is creating greater safety, mm-hmm. for the next generation. And by sacrificing their own comfort to explore something that is not comfortable, they're doing something that will, they're doing the same thing, something that will actually protect the tribe. But because society isn't ready to recognize, or there are large institutions that aren't willing to recognize this issue, that expression of masculinity doesn't get recognized as masculinity and often doesn't receive the same validation or acknowledgement we would give a man who is running into a burning building and sacrificing his safety to save someone.
Right. Yeah. I think about that too, of like, how do we heal as a culture? Like, once this is actually acknowledged, or, you know, really the reality of what's been lost, you know, and I don't have the answer, but, you know, how do we bring healing?
That is a larger question that might require going into the, you know, what is healing and what is the process for that? I think that the key to any healing process is to first give unconditional presence to whatever you're feeling, including the pain. So it would require people to be present with men's feelings around this issue. It would require people to be present with women's feelings around this issue. It would require people to be present with the feelings of the people who perpetrated it and also the people who are the victims. Yeah. And that's the first step. And I think that when people are actually present with the problem, it's actually not that difficult. You know, I always joke that people are afraid to feel their feelings.
Yeah.
But like, if you drop a barbell on your face at the gym, you'll die. You know, like, what are your feelings really going to do to you? Like what honestly, like what are our feelings? How are they going to hurt us? You know?
Yeah.
And I get that they may feel bad, but they are just feelings, right? They're not the same as a actual threat, even though they might feel that way.
Sure. Yeah. So more like the not going into the denial and actually confronting the discomfort.
Yeah. So it starts by being present with the feeling. And I think when you're present with that, then there are a lot of potential solutions. So this is in some ways one of the easiest problems to solve. Like when you have a kid, just don't chop parts of their body off. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
There are a lot of problems in the world that might require, you know, some very large solutions, but this one is actually a pretty simple one.
Yeah. And I understand too that a lot of the implications of the circumcision trauma might not reveal themselves until later in life, where the, you know, man becomes sexually active. And I will say, as a woman who has sex with men in my 43 years of life, and, you know, I've had opportunity to meet some men that actually have damage from circumcision. Things like, and they realize later in life, why can't I feel this part of my penis? And they finally figured it out that it was nerve damage from circumcision. Mm. I met another man who every time he would get an erection, his whole penis would go numb. And, you know, at the time I didn't relate the two, but now that I know this information, the first thought that comes to my mind is that that must be circumcision trauma. What else could that be?
Yeah, it's without knowing the specifics of his experience, I couldn't tell you definitively, but it's entirely possible.
Yeah.
I know there was one Jewish friend who I met through the movement who had so much skin removed that he would bleed during sex, because when he would get erect, there wasn't enough skin, so his skin would tear.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, you know, there's people who have a lot of things like that. And if you're a man who's experiencing it, you might not talk about that publicly.
No, right? But don't you think that we need to have those stories told?
We do.
Yeah.
There are a few of them in my film that we talk about and get into. But our culture is not very good with trauma in general.
Right.
So something deep like this is a greater challenge.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to someone who would claim, and this was actually a comment that somebody commented on one of my posts, a foreskin is not exactly a body part.
What do they think it is?
Exactly.
I mean, that is, so I'll take their statement a step further. I will yes hand them. The foreskin is a social construction. There is no such thing as the foreskin. There is just the penis and then the penis with part of it removed. Mm. I mean, like, where do you say that the foreskin begins and that it doesn't? Is it like, how far up the shaft is it, right?
Mm-hmm.
When people, even referring to it as the foreskin, you're creating like a separate word and a separate symbol for thinking about that part of the penis, but it's all interconnected.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say that if I talk about your hand, you wouldn't think about that as something different from your fingers. Yet
right.
When people think about the foreskin, they think about it as different from the rest of the penis.
Yeah.
And in fact, there are some activists I know who will refer to circumcision as partial penile amputation.
Wow.
Because that is, you know, technically an accurate way of referring to it, that there are, you're removing part of that part of the body.
Yeah. Well, do you mention in the film that it's referred, is it medically referred to as penile reduction surgery, or is that an intactivist?
I'm pretty sure that's an intactivist thing.
Okay.
I think most medical coding would refer to it just as circumcision.
Got it. Okay. You know, one of the things that you don't talk about in the film that I'm really curious to know more about, who profits from circumcision? I think, you know, if we follow the money, we kind of see maybe some of why things are the way that they are. And I'm just wondering if that was an avenue you explored at all but chose not to cover, or is it insignificant? What do you think about that?
We get a little bit into the money, but it is hard to follow that fully. because there are parts of it that may not be fully transparent. And then there's also the larger issue of liability. And I personally think that liability might be an even greater issue. So first, there's the cost of the circumcision itself, which doctors will charge a certain amount for. But if you do it in a hospital, then there's also, you know, they might charge for the equipment. There's the whole industry of making circumcision devices. There is the fact they can package it as a part of birth and all the other expenses around birth. So there's sometimes one price for circumcision, and then there's other things added on. Mm-hmm. The other piece is that the foreskin itself is sometimes sold as biomedical tissue. So
wow.
A child that young has stem cells, and stem cells are very valuable to certain researchers. So there is an entire industry selling children's foreskins. You can go online and find what's known as foreskin fibroblasts, which are just basically a bunch of those cells together. They're used to test things like skin creams. They're used in research. And how much money goes through that, I don't know.
Wow. Yeah, I read an article about that. I think it was, I guess in Korea, they practice circumcision.
Yeah.
As well. And it was an article about the foreskin being used in beauty cream that was then like shipped over here to the States and being used by celebrities. And they were sort of flippantly talking about the baby foreskins that had been used in it, which is just really shocking to me.
Yeah. It's very gross the way that the media often talks about those stories. You know, if there was, and it's used in female beauty creams. And if there was like a group of men who made a pre-workout from like little girls' genitals, you'd think that that was like the most macabre horror thing you'd ever seen. But when it's, you know, done in that context, people think it's a joke because, you know, haha, penis, right?
Right.
But how big that industry is, I don't know. I will say in Korea, the rate has gone down. I think it's below 20% now. And it was only ever high because American doctors came over there during the Korean War and instituted it as a practice.
Wow.
But how big that industry is, I don't know. At one point I was trying to interview someone who ran a company that sold them, and I know he had multiple employees and that he personally made over $500,000 a year.
Wow.
So I assume that if that was just his salary and he's got multiple people, that, it's probably pretty big, but you know, that's not public because your hospital bills might be public and they might say, oh, we just throw it in the trash, but maybe they sell it, you know?
I'm sure they sell it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on.
So, and then how many do they do a day? What's the incentive for them to do that? Like, they might make money on you and then they make money selling it. And does that influence the advice the doctor gives you in terms of telling you what he should do? Mm-hmm. A lot of those conflicts of interest in the hospital system are not that transparent. Mm-hmm. So even those things, I think that the healthcare industry could survive the end of circumcision because there's just so much money flowing through American healthcare. It wouldn't matter. Right.
And
it's not a huge part of the healthcare industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar a year industry. But the healthcare industry is so big that that's not a large number to them. Where I think it really becomes something that they want to protect is liability. So medical malpractice lawsuits are something that every doctor is afraid of. Mm-hmm. And if they were to say that this surgery that they've done on the majority of men in America is actually harmful, and potentially malpractice, and potentially someone could take them to court for, what is the liability of that?
Right. So they would be less likely to admit that maybe we should discontinue this practice because that would be admitting potential.
Right. I think their best scenario is to say, you know, I say best scenario purely from them trying to get the maximum amount of money. I don't mean ethically best, but what they would want is for it to slowly change or just be a choice that people make.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really have to take any ownership of.
Right.
Which, you know, for the past, you know, 100 years, doctors have been the ones promoting and pushing circumcision, and now they kind of want to shift the blame and say, oh, it's up to the parents, right?
Sure.
Never mind who the provider is, who sold it, you know. It's a it's a shift mainly, I think, for liability reasons, more so than any kind of logical argument.
Definitely makes sense. Okay, so I'm going to get personal here for a minute, and you can, of course, decline to answer this, or I can edit it out.
we're so, working on this issue. I'm so far past. You know.
Okay, good. Tell me about your penis. Are you circumcised? Are you intact?
I am. I am circumcised, yes.
And
I was circumcised, I should say.
You were circumcised. So would you be willing to share about your own journey with what that's been like for you, especially as you've become an advocate for intactivism?
I have done a lot of healing work and integration around this issue.
Uh-huh.
I think that when I first discovered it, there was a period of depression. And I actually had an experience during meditation where that was part of what led to me creating the film, mm-hmm. where, you know, initially as I was learning things about circumcision, I thought like, you know, I can change everything else in my life, but there's not really a way for me to change this. So, you know, I'll just push it out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. And during meditation, I practiced Zen meditation at the time. And during meditation, I just sit and be present with whatever feelings came up, just unconditional presence to any thought, any feeling. And during that, I had the word circumcision enter my mind, and I felt this cold sensation in the body. And it was what I would now categorize as a somatic memory. It was a feeling in the body that wanted to be seen, that came from an earlier experience in my life. And this feeling was really uncomfortable. I kind of felt all my energy drain down to my belt. And it happened a couple times during the meditation. So I thought, well, that's odd, but some part of my consciousness must want me to look at this, right? Mm-hmm. So I started researching, and that's kind of what led to the film. And since then, I have had an interest in healing work and integrating those experiences. So now I've studied a lot of different types of healing methods. The most recent one and the most effective I've found is something called completion process. And I'm now a practitioner in that. But the other thing that I found is that even though there was initial pain around what I didn't have and how unfair that felt, that there's now greater awareness in the body. Because if you're not willing to look at what's there, you won't feel everything that's there. And so I noticed that I am much more in my body, much less dissociated, and much more present during the experiences that I do have.
Yeah.
And that it's much easier to talk about sexuality and all of the things that come up and the feelings that I have, because the feelings that I might have tried to avoid, I've gone into. So when you try to suppress feelings, it's not like you can just suppress the bad sensations. Very often what ends up happening is that people numb out of all their feelings or all of their extreme feelings.
Sure.
So the safer it is to go into an extreme negative feeling, the safer it is also is to go into an extreme positive one.
Yeah.
And if you've ever, one of the things that I learned from someone I knew who taught around Tantra was that people actually will try to avoid intense positive experiences or ecstasy. Those, sure. You know, when you start bringing them into that state, it's a little too intense for them and they'll try to back it off. And that the same way that you give presence to a negative feeling is the way that you give presence to a positive one. So for me, what I have found is that that area of my life has gotten better because I've been able to feel more and experience more.
Wow.
And it required also being present with the negative stuff first.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are afraid to go through that because they think they're just going to feel bad.
Sure.
But you can't feel bad forever.
Right. You know? Or it's just like, well, why stir the pot? You know,
right.
Why rock the boat? Things are fine. Sex feels fine. Like, I don't have a problem. So why would I want to make a problem where there isn't one?
You do it because a part of you feels that way, mm-hmm. and every part of you deserves to be heard.
I agree. What do you think we've lost as a society because of circumcision?
You know, I was reading a book recently in which there was an experiment someone did. This is a tangent, but I promise it will get to the answer to the question. They had a group of people working on a project, and they had one person they sent into the group whose job was to act basically like a bad group member. They were either a jerk, or they were really depressed, or they were a total slacker that contributed nothing. And what they found is that the whole group did a little bit worse. The group might not be aware of it, but the energy of that person lowered the productivity of the group. And I think similarly, trauma does the same thing in a society. You might not be aware of it, but there is a way in which trauma lowers the energy of everything around it. Wow. So it's hard to quantify, but I think you could imagine it as the opposite. What would our society be like if there was no trauma? What would it be like if everyone had been perfectly parented? And then work back from there. Okay, what about a small trauma? What about a little more? I think that part of the reason our society is the way that it is because of trauma.
Absolutely.
Because there's all of these things affecting us. And again, you might not notice it consciously, but when people get in an adverse situation, watch how they're triggered. Watch how they explode with anger or hide with shame. Look at how our culture portrays sexuality. And I'm not saying, by the way, that all of this is the result of circumcision. I think that circumcision might, and trauma in general, might be understood as a series of factors. So it's not like eating unhealthy makes you sick, but each more unhealthy behavior you have or more unhealthy thing you put into your diet, the chances go up a little bit, right? Yeah. It's more like a risk factor. You could think of it that way.
Sure. Yeah. And just to like parlay on this, I don't know if you've ever read that book, Peak States of Consciousness. I can't remember the author's name, but one of the things that he writes about in there is, you know, we all have access to these peak states, really those states of clarity, and I guess like the awakened state. But actually what he discovered was it's trauma that actually takes us out of those states.
I've heard enlightenment described as total awareness. When you're aware of everything, there is nothing unconscious anymore. But if you're going to become aware of everything, trauma is one of the things you'll become aware of. And it's also the thing that people are most afraid of becoming aware of.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, would you touch on just briefly, I know this might be a bit of a tangent, but I think that this would be really, I think, important for people to know. You mentioned a little bit ago that female circumcision is now like it's legal again, or?
Oh yeah. So that's an interesting story. So we cover this in the film. In 1996, there was a law passed against female genital mutilation. And the first court case ever of that law took place in Detroit, where there was someone doing, I believe it's what was known as type 1 female circumcision. So there's two different types of female circumcision. There's types where basically everything is removed. And then there's types where what they do is they basically just do a pinprick and draw blood. And I believe that the type that they were practicing there was similar to that type. So in some way, the prosecutors picked the worst court case they could, because even pro-circumcision groups have at times acknowledged that that type of circumcision is less invasive than male circumcision, because male circumcision removes a significant amount of tissue and that type doesn't remove anything. So they were going to court, and I think that the defense had said, and the defense, by the way, had Alan Dershowitz working for them, who's a very famous Jewish attorney, and they were going to argue that this is part of their culture, it's their religious right, and it's less invasive than male circumcision, so it should be legal, because we allow male circumcision, so this should be legal too. And the case ended up, they managed to get the law against female circumcision at the national level overturned on the claim that it was basically a technicality. Like, this is, female circumcision isn't interstate commerce, so the federal government doesn't have the right to regulate it. And I think that they saw this going to court and bringing the male circumcision issue to light. And there was a Jewish judge and Jewish defense, and they said, let's get this out of here. And so now female circumcision is legal at the national level, but many states have laws against it. Similar to how, like, you don't prosecute, most criminal cases aren't prosecuted at the national level, they're prosecuted by the state. right?
Got it.
But this argument still remains on each state law. So we have an equal protection clause in the Constitution that says you can't make a law that only protects one group of person. And I think you could make the argument that laws against female genital cutting are not constitutional because they only protect one gender and they don't protect against male genital cutting. Hmm. And that is the argument that groups that want to practice female circumcision are making. They're saying, well, you guys allow male genital cutting. Why don't you allow female genital cutting? That's kind of sexist. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a slow repeal of those laws that I think is going to happen.
Okay.
And what I've seen from pro-circumcision groups and especially Jewish groups is that they're willing to throw women under the bus to keep their practice alive.
Wow.
That those and a lot of scholars have said those laws are going to get, they're not going to hold up in court. Now, they're not prosecuted often because, you know, we don't know about them. Like if a family from a circumcising culture does this within their community, it's kind of hard to find out that it happened.
Right.
You know, it's the same problem you have prosecuting any abuse of children, is that, like, who's the adult that's going to tell on them? It's not going to be the adults doing it.
So here today in the year 2020, on a federal level, female circumcision is technically legal.
Yes.
Wow. See, I don't think a lot of people know that.
Yep. Yeah, I've thought about doing more media around that.
Yeah.
It kind of happened and it didn't really
Washington, you know, if we were doing to little girls what we do to baby boys, people would be up in arms and storming Washington.
They would.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a law passed in 1996 against it. So.
Wow. Yeah. More. Do more around that. I mean, I think it highlights the male circumcision issue, you know, and really makes, I think we should question why do we allow one but not the other? Why is there this double standard?
Yeah.
And why do we say something's cultural, therefore it's okay?
Right. Yeah, there's a bias in favor of white and Jewish cultures that practice circumcision and a shame put on cultures that practice female circumcision that generally come from brown nations.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Brendan, it's been amazing talking with you. I just want to thank you so much just for coming on here and sharing your wisdom and chatting with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we will be hosting a screening of American Circumcision for those of you who are listening here in Austin, Texas. Stay tuned for details on that. And thanks again, Brendan, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to show your support by subscribing to this podcast series and sharing it with your community. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.